We're continuing this morning along the same subject line that we've been on several exhortations, events subsequent to the return of Christ. And this morning, we're going to briefly consider the march of the rainbowed angel. We could probably deal with a lot more scriptures than we're going to talk about this morning in a lot more detail, but we're going to focus our attention on a few points. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 10, and we're going to read the first six verses there, though on the overhead I have seven. And for those of you watching online, I changed the presentation, so hopefully if you're on a computer you can read this a little bit better. Revelation chapter 10. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. He had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot upon the earth, and cried with a loud voice as when a lion roareth. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever and ever, who created heaven and the things that are therein, and the earth and the things that are therein, and the sea, in the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer. Let's go back to this slide for just a second. This slide is an artist's depiction of Nebuchadnezzar's image being struck on the feet by the stone. And I've put that up there because we're going to focus in the march of the rainbowed angel in the smiting of the image. I said in a previous talk in this series that Nebuchadnezzar's image represents the dominion of Gog. There does need to be some clarification on this, but I think what Brother Thomas writes in Elpis Israel is correct, that the Nebuchadnezzar's image does not represent all the nations of the earth, but it represents the dominion of Gog. Now, like the march of the rainbowed angel, the image may be smitten upon the feet once Christ and the saints enter into Jerusalem and defeat Gog, but that is not the finality of the destruction of the image, nor is it the finality of the march of the rainbowed angel. And in this talk, I'm going to try to take us up to Jerusalem. Now, I think the important thing that I'm trying to say here about this, and when you read Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 2 is I think, makes a specific point that the stone smites the image. Let's equate that with the destruction of Gog. And then all the portions of the image are ground to powder together. Let's equate that with things that are going to happen after Gog's defeat, with the time frame of the scarlet colored beast and the things to do with papal Europe involved in the works. So while the image may be smitten when Christ and the saints come into Jerusalem and defeat Gog, that's the smiting of the image upon the feet, that does not mean that the image is immediately ground to powder in type. We still have to move the march of the rainbowed angel out of Jerusalem and the Lord roar out of Zion to overcome the scarlet colored beast, as it were. And Brother Thomas equates that with the grinding of the rest of the image to powder. So I wanted to make that clarification. That question was asked in a previous point. So when Christ and the saints move forth out of Zion, excuse me, out of Sinai, all right, from the place of the judgment seat to begin the march of the rainbowed angel, we want to give an overview as to what will take place. And the first peoples that will be overcome, subdued, as it were, in the march of the rainbowed angel are those described in Habakkuk chapter 3. Now, I will say this. I think this is a point in which there are some minor details in which you may hear brethren speak of a little bit differently. I choose to think that the march of the rainbowed angel will, as Habakkuk says, move upon the tents of Cushan and Midian first, and then move from Sinai into Egypt. My good friend, Brother Al, believes that is going to be a two-pronged attack that is simultaneous. I don't think that that's a point that necessarily is one we should argue over. Some of those minor points I may be wrong on. So there's a little bit difference that some people have in this regard. But in Habakkuk chapter 3, we read this. And remember the revised version renders the first of Habakkuk 3, verse 3, in the future tense. God shall come from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. His glory covereth the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise, and his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. Let's pause there for a moment. As the march of the rainbowed angel then begins, verse 4 gives us the indication that there will be no revelation at this point in time to the world as to the power that is coming upon them. Though we may certainly take into account from our previous talk the work of Elijah in his work towards the people of Israel, in that the Lord doth come, that there will be some understanding in some minds that this is indeed the work of the Messiah. Pick up at verse 5 and continue. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and drove asunder the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills did bow. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. All right. Our opening reading from Revelation chapter 10, you'll remember that John has the remark there that the angel puts his right foot upon the sea and his left foot upon the earth. I want you to think about that right foot being placed upon the sea, that now we are beginning to see that process of the right foot upon the sea. The destruction of Gog and its forces, when it's complete, and the establishment of the kingdom in Zion, all right? The bringing together of the dominion that is covered from Egypt to Assyria that we see in Isaiah 11. This is all that idea that we would focus on the right foot being placed upon the sea. The left feet upon the earth will happen after the destruction of Gog. So this right foot moving then upon the sea, we see in verse 7, the tents of Cushan in affliction and Midian trembling. Brother Thomas says in Eureka, volume 5, page 249, that the reader must bear in mind that there are two separate and distinct regions known in Scripture by the name of Cush. The one in Asia, now called Cushistan. So it would be interesting for us to find a map from Brother Thomas's day and determine what is Kushistan in Asia. And then sometimes what we think of as Asia today and what he thinks of as Asia as he's writing, the map that I have will kind of show that. The other in Africa styled Abyssinia and Ethiopia. Well, this is an important distinction to make because I believe that the Kush that is being spoken of is exactly what Brother Thomas says here, that this is the area that was known in his day as Kushistan. Now, I've got an old map here from the 19th century on the wall, and it hasn't made it to the overhead yet for those of you on computer. It's in the process of, there we go, it changed for you. If you look on this particular map, and let's see if I can get my pointer. I went ahead here. Let me go back and get the pointer out. Okay, if you look right here, see where it says Kushistan? All right, for those of you online, I'm not drawing a red line, but look just north of what is today the Persian Gulf. This area of Mesopotamia, what we know as the Fertile Crescent, was in Brother Thomas's day known as Kushistan. And I think that makes sense that Habakkuk chapter 3 is describing this move that takes forth into this area that is across Saudi Arabia and into what would be known as today as the Kuwait area and Iraq, because it will equate to what Isaiah 11 will have to say to us, all right, about Assyria and Egypt being incorporated as thirds into the kingdom. It'll equate to another verse that we'll look at in a few minutes in the regathering of those who were scattered of Israel by the host of Gog into those areas as well. If we look at the references that are placed on the overhead, that are on the overhead, and we go to Genesis chapter 2 and read verse 13. Let's look at that. We have a description here in the Garden of Eden, and we have this. Keep in mind that the Garden of Eden, as we know it, was located down on that map, right in that same area that Kushistan is written on there. And we have four rivers that come out of there. And verse 13 says, the name of the second river is Gihon. The same is it is that compasseth the whole land of Cush. Says Ethiopia there, but Cush. So that second river would have gone into this area of what we know today is the Fertile Crescent. In Isaiah chapter, well, let's go to Judges first, chapter 3 and verse 8. Let's kind of move through here in a manner through the scriptures that makes it easier to turn up references. So Judges chapter 3 in verse 8, I think this is a very important reference. Therefore, the anger of Yahweh was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of Cushan, Rithathaim. All right, into Cushan, and what is he called here? The king of Mesopotamia. I think Judges 3:8 is a good Bible marking note to put with Habakkuk 3:7 to demonstrate that the Cush there that is being spoken of relates to the Mesopotamian area. All right, and then the last reference we have here, Isaiah chapter 18 in verse 1. Woe to the land shadowing with wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, that sendeth ambassadors by sea, even vessels of bulrushes and water, saying, go ye swift messengers to a nation scattered and peeled. Well, this particular verse here refers to a land which is beyond the rivers. Now, the Cush that is Africa would probably be river singular, right? If that's what's intended. But because I think it's referring to this territory that puts us to the Fertile Crescent, Isaiah 18 says, the land beyond the rivers. And it puts us into that Mesopotamian area. So Habakkuk chapter 3 then gives us the idea that in the march of the rainbowed angel, one of the first places that is conquered then becomes this territory which is now dominated by Iraq, which will be a portion of Nebuchadnezzar's image, will be a member of the Gogian host. And based on Zechariah 10, we know there will be those of the Jewish people that have been scattered there. And therefore, it would be very important for the rainbowed angel to make that movement. I've got that reference. We're going to look at it later, but it's Zechariah chapter 10:10, if you want to write it down now. I believe it will also be a move that will connect the rainbowed angel to some of those powers that have been allied with Israel at the time of the Gogian invasion. All right, it'll put us into a position to where that Saudi Arabian peninsula, which has stood up against Gog and said, art thou come to take a spoil, will be subjugated to the powers of Christ. And think about some of the references that are written throughout Isaiah and Psalm 72 that speak about the Arabic peoples of that peninsula being a part of the peaceful reign of Messiah the Prince, of Jesus the King of Israel. It will be appropriate that this territory is moved into and conquered because they will become allies, if you will, of the rainbowed angel. Further reading of that is available to you to look at through Eureka. The next point in the march of the rainbowed angel will then be the moving into Egypt. The chart that I have on the overhead, and it should switch in a few minutes for those of you who are looking at this online, comes from a book, The Way to Jerusalem. Many of you probably have that book in your libraries. I think it's out of print now. It's available online, but the booklet, which was a very good booklet, which was written by Graham Pierce. I know a lot of you have this in your libraries. And so we have this movement that will then take place into the area of Egypt. Isaiah chapter 19 and verse 1 describes it thusly. The burden of Egypt. Behold, Yahweh rideth upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt. And the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. The first verse then describes Egypt being overtaken by this swift cloud of Yahweh and his saints. Now the chapter that we're reading from is not necessarily written in chronological order. It's important to note, all right? When we get into the second verse, we're going to see things that are written that take place before the events of verse 1. A time when the Egyptians will be set against the Egyptians. And I think that we've even begun to see that particular portion of Isaiah 19 being fulfilled in recent history with the Arab Spring. We see in verse 4 that the Egyptians will be given over into the hand of a cruel lord and a fierce king. That language mirrors Daniel chapter 8 in verse 23 and relates this cruel lord with the king of the north. Relates us to that power that comes forth out of the little horn of the goat. It relates this to Gog of the land of Magog. It brings this and ties us all together. So we place those verses together and we find then that after moving into the areas of Midian and Cushan, those areas of Saudi Arabia to Iraq, that the rainbowed angel will then ride swiftly into Egypt. And the purpose will be to rescue the Egyptians and whatever Israelites have fled there from the Gogian invader, from the hand of this cruel lord and fierce king. As a result of this, we will eventually get to a point in time later on after the March of the Rainbowed Angel where the verses 17 and 18 of the chapter will come to fruition over a period of time, that the land of Judah shall be a terror under Egypt. Everyone that maketh mention thereof shall be afraid in himself because of the counsel of Yahweh of hosts, which he hath determined against it. In that day shall five cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan and swear to Yahweh of hosts. One shall be called the city of destruction. So we get to this very important period of time in which the rainbowed angel will have overcome the territories to the south of Jerusalem, if you will, and east of it. The Sinaitic Peninsula, of course, will be under control of the rainbowed angel. The areas that we know of Saudi Arabia today, over to the mouth of the Mesopotamia territory, the mouth of the Persian Gulf, and then in Egypt, will all be combined together in this first phase of the march of the rainbowed angel. That illusion that we see there of those areas being first gathered makes sense to us because of the way the 19th chapter of Isaiah concludes. Now, this is looking a little bit further down the road, but this march of the rainbowed angel is setting the stage for these verses to find their fulfillment. In verse 23, we read, "In that day there shall be an highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom Yahweh of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel mine inheritance." Now obviously, that's the reason I phrase this, sets the stage for this being fulfilled, because the rainbowed angel will not have yet moved into Israel. But that territory of Assyria, going into the tents of Cushan, and moving into Egypt will be prepared for that point at this point in time. And I just spotted a typo on this next overhead. This is Zechariah chapter 10. I somehow didn't put the chapter when I put verses 8 through 12. So let's turn to Zechariah chapter 10 and look at verses 8 through 12 right now, because this sets us up to a very important point. In the last talk we gave, we focused on the work of Elijah in going out to Israel, those who have been scattered by the Gogian invader, preaching unto them, teaching them of the Messiah's coming, bringing them into remembrance of the law. And then we get to Zechariah chapter 10, which I think makes sense with where we are at in the march of the rainbowed angel now, because Israel, many are going to stay in the land, but a large portion of them are going to flee from the face of the Gogian invader. We don't have a lot of Jews living today in Assyria, in what's known as that territory. It's Gog that drives them there. It's better if you drink your water instead of breathe it. All right, Zechariah 10, starting at verse 8. "I will hiss for them." The Hebrew word there for hiss, shamak, means to whistle or to pipe. All right, so this is a call. The English word hiss maybe doesn't give the right sense. "I will pipe unto them and gather them, for I've redeemed them, and they shall increase, and they shall have increased. And I will sow them among the people." Well, this verse is very interesting. The reason why they're going to have to be hissed for is because they're going to be sowed amongst the people. Gog will come into the land of Israel and will disperse many of the Jews living in the land of Israel and sow them, if you will, amongst the people and require them to be whistled, piped, or hissed for, if you will. I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children and turn again. I will bring them again also out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria. And I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, and place shall not be found for them. He shall pass through the sea with affliction, and shall smite the waves of the sea, and all the deeps of the river shall dry up. The pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away. And I will strengthen them in Yahweh, and they shall walk up and down in his name, saith Yahweh. So, when we look at these references in Zechariah 10, I think they relate to why the march of the rainbowed angel will take this placing of the right foot of the sea being first into this territory of Cush and then into Egypt, because it helps set the stage for these verses to be fulfilled. Now, they will not all be immediately, all these verses are not immediately fulfilled, obviously, during the march of the rainbowed angel. The stage is being set. The bringing them back into the land will wait for a little bit later time. It will wait until after the rainbowed angel has established itself in Jerusalem. But it sets that stage. There is a reason why the rainbowed angel moves first in these territories. It is to first recover those who are under the hand of the work of Elijah. It doesn't necessarily bring them along on the march at this point in time, all right? But to recover them and to deliver them out of the hand of the fierce king of which they live under, all right? Where do we go to next? And once again, this is a quick overview of some verses. Where do we go to next? The rainbowed angel then will leave the territory of Egypt, and we might think of this actually of having another aspect to that verse of out of Egypt have I called my son. All right, you know, just as the Lord himself in his lifetime of his first advent came out of Egypt into Israel, there's going to be an aspect to that verse that we might apply to this as well as we might apply that to Israel as his first son. Moving out of Egypt, coming into the land of Edom, Moab, and Bozrah. Now we've got two references we're going to look at here, but before we actually look at them, let's just consider one minor point. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 11. I don't have that on the overhead, so turn there with me. Just make a point here that is important. In Daniel chapter 11, during the initial phases of the king of the north, the Gogian king of the north, let me phrase it that way, coming down, we're told in verse 41 that Edom, Moab, and Ammon escape out of the hand of the king of the north, the Gogian king of the north. He moves into Egypt. Verse 43 says, and then comes back when we go down into verse 45 and finds himself planting his tabernacle in Jerusalem. The important point that I wanted to make here as we go from here to Isaiah chapter 34 is though Edom, Moab, and Ammon originally escape the onslaught, it does not mean, and this verse does not teach to us, that they forever escape the power of the Gogian king of the north. Because of what we read in Isaiah 34, we see that's not true. During that initial phase, yes, there is an escape. But when we go to Isaiah chapter 34, and let's turn there now, we start to see that there is a great battle that will take place here in these areas that had originally escaped from the king of the north. So we have verses 1 through 6 on the overhead. Come here, Come near, ye nations, to hear, and hearken, ye people, let the earth hear, and all that is therein, the world and all the things that come forth of it. For the indignation of Yahweh is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. He hath utterly destroyed them. He hath delivered them to the slaughter. Their slain also shall be cast out, and their stink shall come up out of their carcasses, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood. All the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falleth off from the vine, and as a falling fig from the fig tree. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it come down upon Idumea, Edom, and upon the people of my curse to judgment. The sword of Yahweh is filled with blood. It is made fat with fatness, and with the blood of lambs and of goats, with the fat of kidneys of rams. For Yahweh hath a sacrifice in Bozrah, and a great slaughter in the land of Idumea. So we see great battles that will take place then as pushing into Cush and into Midian, then into Egypt, and then moving northward into Bozrah and into this land of Edom. All right, let's turn also at this point in time to chapter 63 of Isaiah. This is a chapter which sometimes carries some debate to it amongst Christadelphians, and we want to make sure we describe it in a way that there is no debate about what this chapter is referring to. This chapter is written after the events, if you will, of Isaiah 34 have taken place. From the perspective, if you will, of those in Jerusalem. And then the question will be asked in Isaiah 63, verse 1. Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? This that is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength. I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel and thy garments like him that treadeth in the wine fat. I have treaden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me. For I will tread them in mine anger, and trample them in my fury, and their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment. For the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. And I looked, and there was none to help, and I wondered that there was none to uphold. Therefore mine own arm brought salvation unto me, and my fury it upheld me. And I will tread down the people in mine anger, and make them drunk in my fury, and I will bring down their strength to the earth. So we have this depiction of this great slaughter that has happened in Edom and in Bozrah, and then there will be a moving that takes place toward Jerusalem. When we read, I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me, it's very important that we understand what is being said here. The Hebrew is very specific. There is no ish with me. Of the people, there was not a mighty man or a warrior with me of the people. The fact that the word people is being used here is trying to emphasize to us that though the Jews living in the land of Israel will have been scattered into Assyria and into Egypt, though they will have been brought back under control of the rainbowed angel and rescued from the hand of the fierce king, the cruel Lord, they are not at this time involved in the conquest that is taking place. It is strictly Christ and the saints. of the people. There are no Jews that will take place here with them. There are Christadelphians who look at this verse and say that this is Christ and the angels alone, then based upon this verse, and of the people there are none with me. There's just simply no logic that would take place for that. Why would Christ leave the saints in Sinai and move on this battle alone? That simply doesn't make any sense to us whatsoever. Particularly, it does not make sense to us when Zechariah 14 is very explicit that who comes with the Lord into Jerusalem? All thy saints with thee. So the only logical conclusion that we can arrive then, when none of the people come with him, none of the mighty warriors come with him in verse 3, it is that Israel has not yet taken on the role of the battle axe. That time is not yet. The work of Elijah is just beginning to see some fruit at this point in time. They have been rescued from the hand of the fierce Lord, cruel Lord, but they are not yet ready to become that battle axe. It is simply Christ and the saints involved in this particular movement. We then come to the battle for Jerusalem. All nations having been gathered there to battle, Christ and the saints will arrive and take part in the combat, in the battle. As Joel chapter 3 describes it, in verses 9 through 15, we will see a great destruction that takes place in Jerusalem now at this point in time, where Christ and the saints will win the day. Let's turn to Joel chapter 3 and read from verses 9 through 15. And there's a reason why I'm going to stop at verse 15, and I'll try to make that point. There's a reason why I'm not going to read through the rest of the chapter. Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles, prepare war, wake up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, come, all ye nations that could be rendered, and gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Yahweh. Let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there will I sit to judge all the nations round about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, get you down, for the press is full. The fats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, or as the margin says, the valley of threshing. For the day of Yahweh is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. And I'm going to stop right there. And the reason I'm going to stop right there, because at the end of verse 15 will conclude the march of the rainbowed angel into Jerusalem in the events of the sixth vial, the overthrow of Gog. Verse 16 will begin the work of the seventh vial and the overcoming of the scarlet-colored beast. There is a pause in the action, if you will, between verses 15 and 16. They are different events, because verse 16 is very specific, that then will come a time that Yahweh shall roar out of Zion. Verses 9 through 15, if you will, are describing the roaring into Zion. There's a reason why it's described as putting in the sickle, for the harvest is come. Because there is an equation here then that takes place with the harvest of the earth described in Revelation 14 in verse 15 as opposed to the vintage of the earth, which will come next in Revelation 14, which takes us on to the destruction, if you will, of papal Europe. Let's also look at Zechariah chapter 14 at this point. Whoops. I just accidentally closed out. The overhead for everybody online. Well, it didn't go away, so that's all right. All right, Zechariah 14, verses 1 through 5. Behold, the day of Yahweh cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Well, let's think about these first two verses in the context of where we are in how we've gone through this series of exhortations. There's a great deal of time that's described here. All right? The gathering of all nations to Jerusalem and the city being taken will begin with Gog entering into the land of Israel as the king of the north. And then verse 45 has, in Daniel 11, has them planting their tabernacles upon the glorious holy mountain. Those would be the events described in verse 2. And then half of the city would go forth into captivity. And then many would be scattered. It does not mean that things immediately come to a conclusion at that point in time. Tarshish and those that are with her will certainly say, "Art thou come to take a spoil to Gog?" They will mobilize for war. They will move against Gog, but they will not be the one to defeat Gog. They will not be successful in that event. It is when we pick up in verse 3 that we will find the defeat of the Gogian king of the north, the Assyrio-Babylonian Gogian king of the north, as Brother Thomas refers to him. Verse 3. Then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west. I lost my place in my reading. And there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. And ye shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountain shall reach unto Azel. Yea, ye shall flee like ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And Yahweh, my God, shall come, and all the saints with thee. This brings the rainbowed angel into Jerusalem. It will set forth the stage for the setting up of the throne of David once again in Jerusalem. Christ and the saints will have become victorious in their march northward and overtake the nation of Israel, rescuing it from the king of the north and establishing the kingdom of God upon the mountains of Israel. There is much confusion sometime around this fourth verse, which thinks that this is the first event that is described in the second advent of the Lord. But as we can see from putting all these other verses together with it, Jesus will not first come to Olivet, as it were. Verse 4 is not describing his immediate arrival unto this earth for his second advent. It is describing just a series of events. It is just one event in a series of events, I should say, which will bring the Lord unto Jerusalem. This certainly will fulfill some words that were spoken concerning Olivet. This verse will set the stage for the building of the temple eventually. through the work of the great earthquake. It will prepare the land for that. But it is a verse that signals the defeat of the Gogian host in the march of the rainbowed angel. The image will have been struck upon the feet. It will fall. Gog will have been pushed out of Jerusalem along with those of Gomer and Togarmah and Magog that have come with him into Israel. What will remain to take place next, and I'll go into that in a future exhortation, Lord willing, will be the work of the everlasting gospel proclamation, and then the overcoming of papal Europe. And that'll still be part of the work of the March of the Rainbowed Angel. But we have reached a point in that march that is glorious, and there will be great joy and rejoicing in this moment when Jesus is in Jerusalem and his kingdom will be established here upon this earth, and it will be prepared to move forth throughout all the globe from this point in time.